Welcome to the Valley College Connection, where John Kawhi and Scott Wigan, two Valley professors, engage in a conversation about success with educators and students. Each week, they'll sit down with a different guest to find out ways each of us have had to plan, persevere, and overcome to where we are now. The show will also highlight resources and services that are working to make a difference at Valley College.
Hi, it's my great pleasure to interview Scott Wigan, the co-host of the podcast. So, Scott, we've been doing this a lot with other people. It's our first time we're doing it with you. So why don't you reel it back as far back as you want to go and just tell us, how'd you end up at Valley College?
Yeah, long and winding road, place I certainly didn't expect to be at. It's funny being on the other side of the microphone here, or the table, so to speak, and answering this question.
Well, let me ask this. How was your academics when you were growing up in elementary school?
Yeah, I was academically, I was good in some areas, I guess. We moved around a bit, which I think for better or for worse made it sort of confusing as to where I was at. Where I was born in Colorado, small town, 2,000, 3,000 people, and lived there until I was 7 or 8. And then we moved out here to California, Simi Valley.
And what was the motivation to come out here?
It was my mother's family was from California, and she wanted to be out here back with her family, whereas my dad's family was all in Colorado. And so it was really driven by that. And we got out here, and I guess in Colorado, I'm trying to think now, I was, middle to high of class when they would do the reading groups and such. We moved out here, and that's not exactly true. Funny, because I've told this story before, but I do have a distinct memory of being in, I guess it was first grade, and, they divide classes into groups of low, middle, and high, and I was in the middle group for reading, and then at one point, the teacher called me up when she called the high group, the really smart kids, the fast readers, and she told me to come up to the table and sit with those kids, and I was really, pretty pleased with myself, and the class actually clapped, I was like, you moved up, I guess, and so I went and sat there at the table, at the round table with all the other kids in the high group, and the teacher was going around, sort of getting oriented and starting to ask questions, and then she looked at me again, and she said, oh, wait a second, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to call you up here. You look like, the other boy who's another blonde-haired, blue-eyed kid in Colorado. This kid, Austin, I still remember his name, who really was, pretty advanced. And she's like, I was just mistaking you for Austin. You're not supposed to be in this group. Go back to your seat. And so my seat at the smart table was short-lived there. Uh-huh. And I went back to my seat and, definitely felt kind of defeated by that, a little embarrassed by it, too. My sister, who was a couple years older than I am, was always in the advanced classes. And so, took that with me, be that as it may. We moved out here to California, and it was on the first day of third grade, and they were doing sort of a reading test in front of the teacher. Because my last name is Wigan, I was at the end of the list. And so, and I was sitting right by the teacher's desk, and so I saw 25 kids read a passage before me. Mm-hmm. And so when it came time for me to read the passage, I already had it memorized. And so I only got through about, 3 lines of it. And she stopped me and she said, oh, stop. Clearly you're advanced. You're in the high group. I said, oh, okay, great. Guess I made it.
Isn't it amazing how all of this is done by second grade?
Oh, my God. Second grade, third grade. And how arbitrary in a way,
right.
Really,
I remember before Common Core. So Common Core now, they sort closer to junior high.
Yeah.
And I remember there was this whole big push that you've got to get your kids up in top third of the school.
Yeah.
In math and reading if you're going to be in the accelerated group in order to get to calculus.
Right.
Because in order to get to calculus, you have to take accelerated math. In order to get an accelerated math, you got to be in the high group by second grade. So I remember my sister telling me, second grade, that's that key year.
Oh,
you've got to nail it, right?
Yeah.
And everything falls off of that.
That's so crazy. I don't remember the math sorting that happened back then. That reading experience definitely sticks in my mind. And then, so I was there in third grade, and then what had happened was the book Colorado that I did in second grade for social studies was the book they were doing in third grade. So Colorado was already ahead anyways. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason. So in third grade and fourth grade and fifth grade in California, I was on the ball.
Mm-hmm.
I was ahead as in all the advanced stuff. And then we moved back to Colorado. So we moved back there for another year because after my parents decided that, now that we're in California, actually we don't like it. It's too crazy. It's too much of a quote unquote rat race, as they were calling it. So we moved back to Colorado and spent another year there. Academically, I was fine, I guess, high or low, just And then came back out here. We were only there for a year, and then came back out here again for seventh grade, which was junior high. And you know, I'm not really sure what happened. I was never tested. I don't remember taking any tests. Whereas my friends who I had in California in fifth grade, who spent sixth grade, definitely were tested because that's where the real sorting happened. Mm-hmm. So I came back into seventh grade, and my friends were in the GATE program, yeah, which I love that acronym, the Gifted and Talented Education program. So they were in the GATE program for math and for English, and I wasn't. So again, I didn't take a test. No one advocated that I should take a test. I think I was just arbitrarily like put in whatever group, you know, sure. Like the middle of the road group.
So I think sometimes it's just, do we have a full class, and which class is empty, and that's just where you go.
Yeah, here's a kid from out of state, you know, doesn't have any of the same sort of.
And you went back to the same school?
Yeah, would have been the same school. Yeah, so at that point we transitioned from elementary to junior high, but it's with my same friends, same mm-hmm. neighborhood, and everything. And so through junior high. Seventh grade, eighth grade, ninth grade, all just regular classes. I saw my friends in those honors classes. I guess it was in ninth grade. Somehow I got into the honors English program. I think you could opt in or advocate to get in. So I was in that, but I was not in the same math track as my other friends who I knew. Got to high school and stayed with the honors English program for 10th and 11th grade. And math, I guess it was Algebra 1 in ninth grade, Geometry in 10th grade. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to be Algebra 2 in 11th grade. I passed the first semester, failed the second semester of it, and then repeated Algebra 2 in 12th grade.
And then how did you enjoy high school?
Overall, I enjoyed it. I wasn't, you know, I didn't hate school at all. I didn't love it. I did like the English class, you know, the writing classes. I got really involved in theater in high school in 10th grade, which, you know, actually, I guess it happened when I was out here in 3rd grade and 4th grade and 5th grade the first time, because the teachers that we had were very musical, and they put on a play every year. And so somehow that came back around in 10th grade and 11th grade, and I ended up in the theater arts program at the high school. And we had a great teacher. He allowed everyone to we'd write our own plays and produce and act and direct and all that stuff. So I did that for 11th and 12th grade. That was probably the biggest sort of social piece of it that I was involved with. Good circle of friends. 12th grade was where you could take AP English, and the teacher had a bad reputation not to take it. And so I went from being in honors, which is 11th grade, to regular English in 12th grade. And it was pretty crazy, the difference in what that, you know, regular English class was like in 12th grade. The level seemed a lot different than what I'd been in before. And yeah, at that point, my other friends were sort of in the AP classes. So I was always sort of straddling both worlds in a way, mm-hmm. you know, a foot in, you know, half of the honors classes. And
well, at that time, did you identify as an English person and not as a math person?
Yeah, I think my experience in failing Algebra 2 probably colored that, you know, perception for how I viewed myself. And that was also, you know, kind of the cliche thing in my family is that, you know, ironically, though, my dad was an accountant, but, you know, even he would say he wasn't a math person, mm-hmm. you know, and my sister certainly wasn't, but we're definitely more on the writing side of things.
Did they push you at all in terms of academics, your parents?
I was never pushed in terms of real pressure, you know, it was just kind of expected. Like a lot of it, I think, was set by my sister because she was such a academically, you know, advanced. She was in all those classes, you know, through high school and everything. And so it was just expected, you know. But I never had pressure. There was no punishments. There was no mm-hmm. rewards for grades or anything like that. Anything that wasn't, you know, if I didn't do something well, it was more of, I guess, sort of self-motivation, you know. Yeah, at that point, you know, I remember I took the SATs, took the PSAT, took the SAT, did pretty poorly on it. Like, you know, I don't know how many points you get for writing your name on it, mm-hmm. but I got those points and
not too many more.
I was, you know, somewhere like 1,040 or something. Mm-hmm. Whereas again, I had friends who hit the 12s or 13s or whatever it was. And so then it was the question, where are you going to go to college at, you know? And my sister at that point had moved back to Colorado. Again, we still had family back there. And she was going to school it was called Mesa State College at the time. And so they had a scholarship program that you could get out-of-state tuition waived. If you could get into the scholarship. So it was writing based. So I wrote an essay for it and got into the program. And so I ended up going there out of high school. So that was my first semester of college. It was back in Colorado.
Did you know what you wanted to be at that point?
No, I loved writing. I was, you know, writing all the time, journals. You know, I just finished up all the theater art stuff where we had done a bunch of creative writing. And so I knew I was interested in writing. I wasn't sure in what capacity. I thought it'd end up being, you know, short stories or plays or poetry or something. So I was definitely focused on that. When I got to school out there, I found an English teacher who was very supportive. It was, you know, one of those lucky, great experiences where he liked my writing, acknowledging it in class and pulling me aside after class and saying, hey, this is something, like, you need to be working on this. And then oddly, it turned out that he'd gone to school, high school, with my dad. which is just a strange coincidence because he was looking for somebody to help us. He owned a handful of different properties around town, and I was, you know, looking for work. At the time, I was working at a hotel out there in the city of Grand Junction doing maintenance, and so I was already sort of had my hand in the work of
property management,
repairs, that sort of thing. And so he needed some help with that, so I was helping him do it. And I was at one of his properties one weekend, and we were retarring a roof that he had. Somehow it came up about where he went to school and what year he graduated. And I was like, oh, that's my dad. And graduated that same year. Who's your dad? Oh, Nick Wigan. Nicky Wigan? We were my class. I mean, it was a small class. That town probably had 1,000 people in it.
Sure.
And so that was a strange coincidence. And then to talk to my dad and be like, yeah, Bob Johnson is my professor, and I'm working for him. So strange, but definitely a mentor and someone who encouraged me with writing.
And at that point, what were you writing on the side?
Really a lot of poetry and sort of short story. I mean, just trying to be creative. Nothing, I wasn't really focused on publishing anything per se, but notebooks filled with things.
You just enjoyed writing for yourself?
Yeah. Definitely a great sort of outlet in terms of thinking through my own thoughts and just being creative. Love the sound of language. How musical it could be. My sister was out there. She'd already been out there. And so I spent that first semester not doing a whole lot of academics other than that writing. It was a pretty social experiment, really. So I didn't last too long out there. I got kicked out of the dorms. And then at the time, I had my high school sweetheart who was still out here in California. And so, I was sort of heartbroken about that. And so after being kicked out of the dorms and not having a place to live, it just made sense. And not doing so well, not being focused academically.
Well, what did you do to get kicked out of the dorms?
We had a variety of things that they didn't like my roommate and myself. I think it was, we're 18 years old and definitely not supposed to be, drinking and smoking in the dorms as we were. And so we sort of had that room that was the room where everybody was in all the time. And so they came in at some point and they found, paraphernalia that wasn't supposed to be there. And they also found, oddly, an ornate knife that my friend from India had given me that was purely ornamental that I had as a souvenir in some box. And they found that. And that was used really as that and drug paraphernalia, which is marijuana, that they said, yeah, you're out. And I protested it and had to write a letter. And still at that point, I was like, I'm done anyways. I don't want to be here. So left and came back to California again. A couple semesters off at that point, working odd jobs. And then even before I had gone to school in Colorado, I'd wanted to go to Santa Cruz, UC Santa Cruz. I'd had a friend who was there, and I'd visited Santa Cruz when I was in high school and spent the night up there and just fell in love with the campus and sort of the culture up there. So applied to Santa Cruz, which I guess I had applied in high school too. I got accepted to it. I just didn't go. I went to Colorado because I had the scholarship. And so I reapplied, and they said, yep, you can come on up. So I went to Santa Cruz and then spent 2 years up in Santa Cruz up there. Lived in the dorms up there again, and was pursuing creative writing, and they had a creative writing program there. And that was at the time when Santa Cruz did not have grades. It was a pass-fail system.
Right.
It was, some the last few years of that before Silicon Valley really sort of exploded and they shifted towards grades. So it was all pass-fail with written evaluations.
Were there still people camping out in the woods outside? And
Yep. We took some hike one of those days and ended up in a weird trailer park that we didn't know was back there. People living back there.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was definitely.
You have students living in trees, tree houses, campsites.
Yep, it is a time capsule over there in a lot of ways, especially then. I've been there, been through there recently, and it's definitely changed. Not the same sort of vibe that it was back then. And this was in 96, I guess, which even then, you talk to people who were there in the 80s or the 70s. Whole other experience, but I was still pursuing creative writing at that point and had submitted my portfolio for the creative writing program and didn't get in. And so I remember that. I was just utterly dejected, pretty devastated by it. So didn't know what to do and decided that I would change majors and change to politics. They didn't call it political science there. They called it politics because it fell within the humanities as far as we think about guided pathways and sorting. Oh, it's an interesting sort for it. I had some great instructors, professors there who I loved. And so I was like, I love what we're talking about here. It was a lot of political philosophy. And so I switched majors to that. I was there for 2 years, and then again, still sort of dealing with the relationship issue that I had before that took me out of Colorado, not focused academically. It just felt like I was kind of floundering. I'd been working the whole time up there, again, doing maintenance at the dorms, which living in the dorms and working there doing painting and repair and all that sort of stuff, and working a handful of other jobs, but finances were tough, and then my dad was also not doing well health-wise. And so then it made sense to you know, for me to stop. It was too expensive, and I, you know, wasn't really moving forward.
And then, so at this point, you had, what, 3 years of credit?
Yeah, I had 2 years in Santa Cruz, and I guess 2.5 years. 2 years in Santa Cruz, and then that semester in Colorado. And so I came back down to Simi Valley again and took another year off. Kept working in sort of these maintenance jobs, got a job at a hotel out in Simi and worked out there doing that. And then, you know, was just spinning my wheels and trying to figure out what to do. Still writing, pursuing the writing on my own. And so, you know, thought, you know, I should go back to Colorado again. That's sort of been the pattern I'd already been in, you know, my entire life, moving back and forth.
And has your girlfriend been following you to all these different places?
No, nope. She didn't. She was stuck at Simi. And that was sort of at the point where I came back from Santa Cruz, where there was the real kind of final split between us. So then I applied again to the college in Colorado. Then with the first semester, went back there again. Mm-hmm. Moved back there by myself. At this point, I didn't have any family back there. And started school again there and picked it up and did a year of school there. At this point, I was older and definitely more focused. You know, I remember, I do remember taking whatever the math requirement was, the college algebra, and actually got an A in it. I was really surprised. had a different type of focus, though. Continued to work at that hotel doing maintenance. And then my best friend, who was living out here in California, was working for an internet company, right, when all that was blowing up, you know, all the IPOs and everything. And he's like, you know, I'm in. I can get you a job. This is going to be one of the big ones. If you should come on back out here and let's work together and let's make this happen. And I was like, oh man, you know, I've already been, you know, out of school, in and out of school for the last 5 years, and I don't have anything to show for it at this point. And he had out of high school, went to Berkeley and graduated in like 3.5 years with a double major. Mm-hmm. And so here I am, you know, 5 years later with nothing really, a bunch of random scattered units. But he was persuasive, and I was like, all right, I'll leave. And so I left college, left Colorado again, and moved back out to California, out here in the Valley. And we worked for an internet company there for a while, and it did IPO, and, you know, some people made a bunch of money, and most people didn't.
Well, were you able to, did you get stock options? Were you able to cash in stock options?
We're supposed to, but no, none of it came together. The CEO, you know, the high-level folks made it, and then the company was sold, and then we had this chance to moved to Virginia with a new company, and my buddy wanted me to go with him. I was like, I can't move again. Like, I got to finish school at some point here. As much as I didn't have pressure from my family about grades, as I said before, there was definitely the expectation that I was finishing, you know, college. I mean, that was sort of, you know, drilled into us. You know, no matter what you do, you're getting your degree. Mm-hmm. And my mom didn't finish college. She had a couple semesters of community college. My dad, you know, had his bachelor's degree. But his brothers were, you know, lawyers and doctors, and my mom had professors and doctors in her family. So there was definitely the sort of
expectation
that was going to happen. So I didn't go. I stayed out here and went to CSUN, and I had been avoiding CSUN like the plague. You know, it's the school in my backyard. The last place I wanted to go was to CSUN. So when I finally, you know, bit the bullet and said, all right, I'll take some classes at CSUN and start going there. This was actually while I was still at that internet company before it shut down. And I started taking classes and did the English major there. There was no requirement as if you want to do it, so I did it. And yeah, lo and behold, it was amazing. It was fantastic. The quality of teachers, the program was better than what I had experienced in Colorado and Santa Cruz. Different, you know, but definitely aspects of it that I really enjoy.
Well, what do you think was different between the UC system and the Cal State system?
For some of those classes, certainly the UC system was the, you know, the lecture hall, 500 people in a lecture hall, and then meet with your TAs, you know, afterwards. Mm-hmm. So that was different. So CSUN was certainly more personal, intimate. Professors knew who you were. It wasn't the TAs, you know. But again, Santa Cruz is an anomaly. And so aside from that, the other classes there, and even the way it was set up with the dorms and sort of your home dorm and the instructors that you had was pretty intimate and personal. So I don't know if Santa Cruz compares, at least when I was there, to a typical any other place, you know. Mm-hmm. But the quality of teachers that they had at CSUN and the program and the curriculum and what, you know, just the approach, everything was amazing.
Yeah, I found the Cal State teachers a lot kinder.
Yeah, nicer.
Very active. They're actually at their office hours. Yeah. They remember names.
Yeah, they want to mentor you. They want to be there. They want to be teaching. They're not necessarily, you know, first and foremost pursuing some other sort of research or writing. One of the things that at the time was pretty disappointing is that I got to CSUN and so many of my classes didn't articulate, and I couldn't believe it. I was like, what are you talking about? These are from UC. And, you know, CSUN almost had a chip on their shoulder about it. Like, yeah, they're not us. Like, we have different standards, and these classes aren't going to count for X, Y, and Z. So I ended up having to take so many classes over. So the stuff I did in Colorado and then the stuff at Santa Cruz, only a handful of it transferred over. Mm-hmm. So I ended up with so many excess units when I graduated. Oh, my God. we talk about all this guided pathways. I was definitely the person who had, I don't know what it was, 150, 160 units coming out of my bachelor's degree, probably. But yeah, started the program there at CSUN and loved it. It was doing great. Continuing to work at sort of the internet company at that time, a few other jobs, and then at some point I saw in the newspaper there at CSUN, the Sundial, that they were looking for tutors at the writing center there, and I thought, hey, you know, I like writing, maybe this would be a job to get. So I went and applied, got the job, and started the job on the first day, and was sitting there, and it was a tutoring space that had undergrad and graduate students in there. And my first student that they asked me to tutor was an ESL student who just come over to the country, and his writing was really challenging for me to read. And I looked at it, and all I could say was, like, this isn't right. I couldn't explain why. I didn't know what the rules were. I just knew as a native speaker, like, well, here's a comma and a period, and here's...
this sounds right.
This sounds right, but... which, you know, made me realize right away, like, oh my God, like, I don't even know how to explain this. And then a grad student came over and sat down and tutored the student, and the grad student was a linguistics major, and so he had all this linguistics theory and background that allowed him to break things down in a way that just completely intimidated me. And so after that session was over with, I was like, oh, I'm definitely not qualified for this. There's no way I'm doing this. And so I went to the director's office and quit and said, like, hey, I'm not qualified. Like, I can't do this. And she said, slow down, it's your first day, you know, give it a little bit of time, like, you'll find your footing here. If you don't like it after a couple of weeks, then quit, but give it a little bit more time. So then I said, okay. So then I went and got all the grammar books I could get, and you know, started reading all the handouts, and started to accumulate the sort of portfolio notebook I'd carry around of all the rules and lessons and things that I thought I would need to know. And all the tutoring sessions I'd have, someone would ask something that I didn't know the answer to, I'd write down that question, follow up on it later. So, you know, settled in there and started to feel pretty confident. It was great, though, being in a space that did have grad students there, because you could sort of see what it looked like at a different level. Mm-hmm. Continued to work there. And then they had a class called the Northridge Review, which was the campus literary magazine, which was the collection that came out every year of short stories and plays and poetry. And so I took that class. And then within the class, they would select someone to be an editor. And so I don't know how I selected it. I don't know if I... asked to be or it's based on writing or what, but somehow I fell into the role of editor there, and the previous magazine's editor would always be there, sort of the pattern that they had to mentor in the new person and show them, you know, how it works and the ropes and what to do and how to do things. And so that person was Tracy Bachman, who's a professor here in the English department, and so she was going through grad school, so we were at grad school at the same time. She was a year ahead of me there, though. And so she took me sort of under her wing and was showing me, you know, here's what it looks like, here's how to do this. And then she ended up sharing with me that Valley College was looking for tutors in the Writing Center. And so I said, oh, okay. So I went and applied over here and got a job in the Writing Center at Valley College with Deborah Harrington, who was the director at that time. And so I was working at both CSUN and Valley doing tutoring there as I was finishing up undergrad.
At that point, were you thinking about becoming a professor, or...
Not really. I hadn't really, you know, sunk in that sense that that's what I wanted to do. I did know that working with students and being involved with writing and you know, tutoring and teaching in that sort of capacity was something that I really enjoyed, and it was something I enjoyed way more than every other job I'd had. And mm-hmm. I'd had a lot of jobs, whether they were office jobs or blue-collar jobs or service jobs or whatever it was, like... if you name it, I've probably done it or some aspect of it. And so I knew that this was something that was definitely more meaningful, that I found value in, that seemed like it was making a difference, that I enjoyed it wasn't, you know, mm-hmm. completely pointless work. So I knew that, but I still hadn't said, like, oh, I'm going to be a professor. You know, I hadn't really made that, I guess, that jump yet. It was right around that time that the director of the Writing Center, Deborah Harrington, along with, I think, Deborah DeCesare here, and I'm not sure who else was involved, had written a grant. It was called the STARS Grant. And One of the unique things about that grant is that it was a FIPSE grant, and FIPSE is the Fund for Improvement of Postsecondary Education, which is a Department of Ed grant. And those FIPSE grants, from what I was told and understand, they don't give them to community colleges. Like, it's a rarity. Those are usually for universities. But we got one here at Valley, the STARS FIPSE grant. It was a 3-year grant. And the whole crux of the grant was really professional development. And the thing that was kind of unique about it at the time was, seems obvious now, of course, it's really the student voice. How do you bring the student perspective into the conversation about professional development with faculty in the room? And so it ended up being, you know, workshop after workshop of gathering of faculty and students in the same room talking about teaching and learning and what works and what doesn't work and getting the straight from the student's mouth about what they like and what they don't like. And then having instructors start to think that through and figure out ways to incorporate those changes into their teaching, into their pedagogy, into their curriculum, the course outlines. Because I was being ran out of the Writing Center with Deborah and I was working there, at that point I was, you know, one of the senior tutors there. And I'd graduated, just finished finally the undergrad, and then I was at sort of this crossroads again about what to do. And I had another good friend who I had met in Colorado, one of those times when I was going to college out there, who just finished college, and he'd gotten a job on the oil rigs out there. And, you know, those jobs pay good money. Super dangerous work, obviously.
Sure.
And he had a job for me. Come on out, man. I got your job. Like, let's do this. You know, I got a place out here. Like, we'll be set. And so I was kind of on the fence, you know, oh, should I move back to Colorado and, you know, jump back into this other type of work or stay out here? And at that time, my mentor, Deborah Harrington, you know, convinced me and said, no, there's, you know, why would you go do that? Like, you just finished. Just go to grad school. Don't stop now. You have momentum going behind you. Stay, keep working here. There's going to be an opportunity at this grant to help out and see how that feels. And so I said, all right, I did. Started grad school the next semester, and then became sort of the helper, the person for that grant. And so she was the director, of course, but I was my official title was, it might have been professional expert at one point that the district had, or some mm-hmm. sort of, you know, coordinator person. And so I was involved with, you know, every aspect of the grant in terms of taking minutes at every meeting that there was, you know, for every speaker that we had, coordinating that, getting the person there, taking minutes, doing summaries of every single workshop that we had. And so didn't know it, but at the time it was like probably the best education in terms of teaching and pedagogy. We had speakers, you know, from across the country coming to the college, and they would give their workshop, and I'd sit there and take notes and then type them up and do a summary and put it on the website. And that happened for, you know, 70, 80 workshops or something.
Wait, what a great apprenticeship you have.
Yeah, it's crazy. And you know, to her credit, Deborah Harrington gave me all sorts of responsibility and autonomy and trust in doing all those things and took me to every meeting on campus. You know, all the meetings that she was at with all the administrators and other faculty, like, I was there taking notes or taking minutes and brought me along just as a colleague, you know, and put me in that position. So I truly had a unique experience in doing that, and it was by way of that it really, as well as the classes I was taking then in grad schools, the critical theory classes, and sort of understanding that there was this niche within English of composition and rhetoric that I really liked. Then it started to become clear that, oh, this teaching is definitely the path to go into. So as I finished up grad school, that grant was coming to an end, and Deborah, director at the time, moved on, and she left and got a dean job at another college. And so that opened up this interim position in the Writing Center. And at that point, I was, you know, a semester away from finishing grad school. I was working on my thesis, which was on writing centers and critical pedagogy. And they asked me to be the interim director if I could do that for the couple months as they were trying to put the position together, which I said, yeah, you know, I'd be glad to. Thank you for the opportunity. But then it became apparent that, you know, they were going to float the actual position out there, and I didn't have my master's degree yet because I was working on this thesis. Mm-hmm. So I made the decision to stop working on the thesis and take the comprehensive test that semester and test out of it, because I had all the units.
Sure.
That was done. And so studied, did it, tested out, and finished that semester, and that was in June, and then they floated the position in July. And that was for the writing director of the Writing Center. And so I applied and got the position, which, again, to sort of, you know, the credit of Deborah, I knew everybody. I'd already mm-hmm. been on all these committees. And even if I didn't know everybody, at least I wasn't a complete stranger. It was the face that they saw sitting there taking notes, you know,
sure.
and had been involved in a number of different things and was definitely tied to that STARS work. So as I was hired, we still had to finish out the grant. And so they asked me and Sally Raskoff to be co-directors of the grant. to finish it out. So then we had the last year of the grant to finish, and then there was a one-year extension on it too, which was another great experience as far as, you know, how do you do the grant reports, how do you do the budget, you know, mm-hmm. for a federal grant.
So at this point, you are in charge of this grant in terms of professional development, and then are you in charge of the Writing Center at this time?
Yep. So July 2007, that's when it officially started, director of the Writing Center. And at that point, the Writing Center was a separate department. It was a standalone department. It was not part of anything else. It was just the Writing Center as a, you know, full-time instructor special assignment. And then, yeah, Sally and I were co-directors of that grant, so it was to finish up that grant. So that was, and as I was sharing earlier when I was telling the story to somebody else who'd ask kind of bits and pieces of it. One of the things in reflecting back on it that was unique too is that most people, when you get hired for these faculty positions, you know, you sort of sit there and think about like, oh, which committee am I going to be on? Like, they tell you should be on a committee, like, sure. Choose at least one, right? I was already on like 7 or 8 committees, you know, just because of what I'd been previously doing. And I'd already sort of fallen into this pattern of saying yes. And so people would ask like, hey, can you do this? Yeah, sure, I can do it. And then, yeah, at a certain point, I was on like 8 committees. And then at a certain point, even, you know, my first or second year into this probationary thing, I was chairing probably 2 or 3 of them.
Which is amazing. And now you're sort of at this state where if you're in a committee, everyone makes you in charge.
For better or for worse, you know, I don't know, probably for worse for everybody.
I mean, part of the thing why is that you have this talent for making everyone feel included, keeping peace within hard conversations, and then moving forward with actual deliverables. I think on this campus, I mean, we have a lot of committees that are well-intentioned, but just nothing ever comes out. And I think usually the way I pick my committees is by who leads it. Because I know there are certain people that just stuff happens. And regardless of what the intention of the committee is, stuff just happens, you know. And that's just sort of uniformly what happens with whatever you touch, that stuff just happens.
Well, thank you. I think I've been fortunate, again, in the sense that I was just thrown into the fire with all that stuff early on. And so over the course of the last, you know, 17 years, who knows how many committees I've been on and had the opportunity to chair. And so I've definitely sat through my committees and chaired committees too that were ineffective, didn't do what they should have done. But I think it's been something as I've continued to be involved in the work that certainly has developed and evolved. And I had a chance to work with all sorts of awesome people, amazing people along the way that sort of, you can kind of see, what makes it work, what doesn't work, and how to sort of navigate.
So what is your role now at the school?
So that was 2007 is when I was officially hired, and then it was also right around that time that the district and Deborah Harrington, who had been the director of the Writing Center, came back to the district in an administrative position at the district as a dean. And then she was interested and always has been interested in professional development, and that's where that STARS grant came from. And so she took those ideas and sort of evolved those into what became aspects of it became the district's FTLA, the Faculty Teaching Learning Academy, which is a, you know, intensive sort of program that the district has been running now for 10, 11 years. And because I had worked with her on that STARS program as she was sort of developing that, you know, she was asking me for my feedback and input, and we ended up, along with another instructor, Bradley Vaden, sort of being the quote-unquote founders of the FTLA.
Which is basically training for teachers over the winter?
Yeah, so it happens in January. It's 9 days of intensive training in preparation for the spring. And then throughout the spring semester, it's meetings once a month to sort of see where people are at. And so it allows folks to redesign a course, really, you know, infusing technology into it, infusing culturally responsive teaching practices into it, all aspects of, you know, student-centered pedagogy, all that sort of stuff. And so I got thrust into that in 2008. I guess that's not really fair to say thrust. I had the opportunity to do it, and I was always sort of on the fence. It was something that I loved doing, and it was continuation of that work, but also, you know, I'm not really qualified. Like, who am I to be teaching other teachers how to teach? And so you show up at the FTLA, and there's people who've been teaching for 10, 20 years.
Right, but you have, like, an encyclopedic knowledge of teaching, you know?
By way of that STARS grant, I'd been sort of, you know, immersed in all that.
I mean, most of education theory that I know of comes from being in a meeting with you, hearing you say some word that I never knew about, Googling it, going on YouTube, and finding out, oh, that's actually matters.
Yeah.
And I basically am always just trailing whatever words you say. Like, I got to write that word down.
you're too kind, man. But that, you know, I remember showing up for that first one and just being so, you know, I've been teaching that class at CSUN, and then I started teaching, you know, at Valley too. And so I was teaching English 101 or 102, but only a couple years of actual teaching, aside from all the theory and workshops I'd been in. And so I was really scared. And so I remember that first FTLA, you know, I went and got like the actual like professor blazer, mm-hmm. you know, put the blazer on and
a little bit of confidence,
put my glasses on. Let me wear these glasses and try to look a little older and a little more qualified for this. Got through it. And then again, to the credit of I think Deborah and Bradley Vaden, who were just great mentors, you know, never for one minute showed in any way that they doubted that I was qualified to do it. It was like, yeah, of course this is what you're doing. Get up there and do it. Like, you've got this to share, go share it. And then I think that was really something too that allowed me to feel comfortable talking in front of faculty, because it was time and time again, you know, I did the FTLA up until just the last few years, where every year is do that. And then every year that would change my teaching too, because every year we'd have to go through redesigning the class and bringing in speakers. And so necessarily I'd have to change my own class. I couldn't teach all this stuff and be exposed to it and then keep my class static. So it was always changing. And that I think is probably what also carried over to some of the work in the committees about being comfortable talking and sort of negotiating conversations and sort of fielding questions and that sort of thing. That happened up until, again, last few years. But you asked about my current job now. So that was mm-hmm. 2010, 2008 that started. And then it was in 2014 that the college decided to consolidate the tutoring into one program. And I see you smiling now. You were part of that decision.
Yeah, I remember they called us in and asked us how we wanted to organize tutoring, and I was in charge of the math lab. And I remember telling them that I want you to take every responsibility they hate and give it to Scott.
Thank you, John.
And then make Scott my boss, because he's much better at this than I am.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, that so you sort of had that perspective on it. And then the Learning Center director at the time, Phyllis, had sort of run her course of doing that, and was time for a change for her, and she was no longer interested in doing it and wanted to teach in the classroom. So then it was kind of like the perfect storm. Okay, you know, the person's resigned from or retired from that position. You were interested in what you were advocating. They floated that position and no one else applied for it. So it wasn't like there was some grand demand of who would want to do this.
I think it's one of those things where who would take that job from you?
Yeah. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things where I think you never put yourself forward, but everyone else does. So when we're in a committee, you don't ask to be in charge. We just all vote for you to be in charge.
Yeah.
And you say, well, I don't know if I'm qualified. Like, well, we think you do a better job than the rest of us. And the same thing here is that what happened was tutoring on this campus needed an advocate. Yeah. And it was basically separated in three different people, none of whom had enough time to be at all the meetings and actually advocate for its mission and growing it as a major service on this school campus. I mean, it had always worked, but there was no plan. We just sort of survived semester to semester doing the best we could. And they're some of the most successful services we have, but we didn't have a vision for it.
Yeah.
And I think putting you in charge gave it a vision, right? I mean, describe some of the things that you've done to improve the tutoring.
Well, and again, thank you for kind words. I think part of that vision and sort of thinking that through is, you know, a product of Deborah DeCesare, the dean who oversees that too, and sort of understanding from sort of the administrative perspective about the advantage to having that sort of unified way of looking at things. And so she was somebody who, you know, from the point when I was hired in 2007 up until now, has always continued to sort of allow me to be creative and have enough trust in me to sort of, you know, try things out, sort of work very collaboratively and be very open about, you know, here's what we're doing, here's our goals, how are we going to achieve them. So I feel like the success that we've had with tutoring and sort of the way that we've been able to unify it has, you know, been a product of a lot of people, from her as the dean to all the other faculty when you were doing it, to the people who are involved now. I think one of the things that we've probably made the biggest gains on is training of tutors. And so training was always an important part of it when I came in and was a tutor, and we've continued that, but I think we formalized it. And so now with the training program, which is the CRLA, it's the College Reading Learning Association guidelines that we are certified by that organization. And that took some heavy lifting to get that certified. That was, you know, many pages and documents and hours that other people, Holly Batty and Faye Sheikhoslami and Jose Cancino, a bunch of people had collaborated on putting that together and showing that we had the components to allow us to be nationally, you know, accredited, so to speak, or certified by this organization. Then after being certified, we had to be recertified and a couple of years later and show that we're continuing to do it. But it allows us then to have our tutors go through the program, and then we can certify them at different levels depending on how much training they've had. And the great thing about it is that they take that certification with them.
So it's on their resume.
It's on their resume. So when they finish Valley and they go to UCLA or wherever they are, they're at, they can say, I'm CRLA certified level 2 or level 3 master tutor. And then for anyone who's looking to hire, you see that. And it's like, oh, this person's already trained. So it's definitely a big advantage for the tutor. So I'm very proud of that work that we've been able to accomplish. There's been all sorts of things in terms of, I think, technology that we've been trying to leverage, whether it's been redesigning the website or sort of, you know, thinking through what makes more sense for online tutoring, from doing it in-house to sort of outsourcing, you know, now that to third party. Trying to bring in equity and equity focus to our training and our tutoring. Those are some of the different aspects of it, workshops that we continue to do across the different areas. There's many other things, you know, our program review and our goals and ideas for how to continue to sort of improve tutoring and evolve it. It's one of the best parts about the job because it allows for all sorts of creativity and input from everybody.
Yeah, and I think you've expanded tutoring to places where it didn't exist before, and that with the athletes.
Yeah, the student-athlete population with the zone.
With EOP, with, right? And that's been, I think, a really change in philosophy of bringing tutoring to places where people are most comfortable on this campus.
That has been, and that's been, you know, with that spirit of let's try it and see if it works, and if it doesn't work, we'll try something else. So we've been experimenting with that for some time now, these sort of satellite locations. It had to do in the Mosaic with reaching, specifically working with Black Scholars or working with the Dreamers, mm-hmm. Or working with the Family Resource Center and sort of having tutors, you know, bring the tutor to the student as opposed to ask the student to come to the tutor. So we see some success with that. At times, I still wouldn't say that it's necessarily the best program, so we're still trying to work that out. Mm-hmm. But there are people like yourself on this campus, and some of the newer faculty too, who are involved, like, you know, who we interviewed before, Elliot Coney.
Faculty on this campus.
And they bring in these different perspectives about how to do things differently and what they've seen or what they've heard. And so I think the more open we are and flexible and willing to experiment and try things differently, then we'll continue to expand and grow. I think the big challenge that we have is finding ways to make tutoring attractive to students who need it. Mm-hmm. Because that's the biggest challenge, and is that a lot of times the students who use tutoring are the ones who already have pretty high GPAs, and they're looking to take that 3.5 to a 4.0.
Right. It's a question of how do we get the D student who just needed a little more push to pass to actually ask for help.
That's it. That's the question we've been wrestling with, and we've all sorts of different philosophical approaches to it, practical approaches to it. You know, the stigma of tutoring always comes up. It's seen as remediation or deficiency. Oh, we need to change that. We need to change people's perception of it. We need to make it more accessible. So we continue to experiment with it. And I think with AB 705 and Guided Pathways, we really are at this perfect sort of place and time to try something different and see what might be more attractive to students.
Well, let me ask you a different last question that I ask most of our guests.
Yeah.
I see just the number of just sheer hours, just man hours that you put into this. And I know the most important thing in your life is your family and your kid.
Yeah.
Right. So the question I have is, what is the motivation? What is the thing that you have that you're working for on this campus? Because I just see this, just the huge commitment that you have in terms of just time. What is it that you're working for?
You know, I think part of the thing that excites me or that I'm working for is I feel like there is just so much potential on campus here. I see so many amazing professors, so many amazing administrators, so many amazing students. We're just surrounded by, I feel like, excellence all the time. And the thing that inspires me or and also sort of frustrates me and I think is the challenge is that it seems like it's not quite threaded together.
It's not well organized.
Yeah, and it's just pockets of amazing people and areas. And what I'm interested in, and that's why I work on the committees and do these other things outside of the tutoring too, is trying to work towards this other, articulating with the campus what this vision looks like for what we could be. What does this excellence look like when it's fully, you know, hitting on all cylinders?
Right.
And it would be very different if we were working in a situation where, you know, we didn't have committed people, that there weren't, you know, amazing, talented students and faculty and people who had passion and desire. If we were working in some sort of place where there's an absence of that, then I probably wouldn't have the same motivation. But it's not. It's the exact opposite. So I see that every day. And, you know, again, part of it inspires me. Part of it drives me crazy. It's like, wow. Right. We're so close. Like, what's the tipping point here?
It's the serendipity of education. That I happen to be the right person who happened to bump into the right, just like you and Deborah Harrington, right?
Right.
What if you bumped into the wrong person? Or what if CSUN had some filtering? right? Yeah. That didn't allow you to be an English major.
Right.
Right. That messaged you in a different way.
Yeah.
And you'd probably be on an oil rig right now.
That's true. That's true. After that happened, my friend broke his back.
No kidding.
Serious injury. Yeah, he recovered now. But it was you know, a couple months later that he called me and was, you know, here's what happened, man.
So, yeah, there's this the very famous professor out of Carnegie, and he was inspired by a teacher at Pierce College, and he had been a landscaper there. Hmm. And when that professor from Pierce College had retired, all these students came back to go visit him, and they all went and tell him, like, you know what, you changed my life. And the teacher was really sad, and he said, I wish it didn't have to be me. Hmm. I wish this didn't have to be such a special moment.
Right.
I wish this, it didn't take serendipity for us.
Right.
I wish this just could have been organized in the regular experience of every kid that comes here.
Yeah. Oh, that's beautifully said. That's
right.
Beautifully said.
And I feel like we have these teachers who are working really hard and doing great work. We have students here who want a different life. And the question is, how do we sort of grease the wheels so these great relationships and opportunities are just easy to come by.
Yeah, right. It's the default. It's just what happens.
Yeah.
It would be the anomaly if it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
That's the vision.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Scott, if a student wanted to meet you, where would be the best place to find you?
I'm in the Writing Center, second floor of the library, room 229. That is where my office is at. Stop by anytime.
You've been listening to the Valley College Connection radio show and podcast with Professors Scott Wiegand and John Kawai. If you would like to be a guest, recommend a topic, or find out more information, please email kvcm@lavc.edu. That's kvcm@lavc.edu. This has been a production of 95.1 KVCM Monarch Radio, the voice of Valley College, and the Broadcasting Club. Thank you for listening.